From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. COVID cases are falling fast in the U.S. 96,000 new cases yesterday. That's down a third from a month ago. So, crossing my fingers as I ask this, are we turning a corner here? Our next guest suggests that with a few interventions, we might be able to. Dr. Lena Wen is back with us. She's an emergency physician and professor of public health at the George Washington University, and she's on Skype. Hi, Dr. Wen.
Hi, Scott. Great to join you.
Good to have you again. Now, you have a new opinion piece in the Washington Post with three big bullet points. And number one is vaccine for kids. One out of every four infections these days is in this group, right?
That's right. And I wrote this op-ed because I think we need a level set and accept that COVID-19 is here with us for the foreseeable future. But that doesn't mean that we have to live in a state of crisis where COVID dominates every decision. Ideally, we're able to reach a high enough level of vaccination across the country so that we can suppress infections. But even if we can't, I really believe we can get to a place where the pandemic is no longer the top consideration for everything when it comes to school and travel and work with three things. And the first is we really do have to have vaccines for younger children, because if we don't, there are a lot of parents, including me and my husband, who have two young kids, who are living as if we are unvaccinated. We're living with that much caution because of our children.
Right. And what is the potential timing here on vaccines being available for kids age 5 to 11 and for kids under 5 eventually?
Yeah, so the FDA has announced that they are meeting October 26th to look at the authorization for children in the 5 to 11 age group. Now, the CDC is not meeting until early November, and so I would say that at this point, the earliest that the vaccines could be available for this age group for 5 and older is probably early November. Pfizer has also said that they will have data for the 6 months and above by the end of the year, and so I think we're looking at early 2022 for authorization for all kids 6 months and older. And in the meantime, the best thing that adults can do to keep our children safe is to get vaccinated ourselves.
All right. And that's to prevent as many cases going forward, as you're describing, to get COVID down to this manageable thing in society. We know, of course, that we will see some cases with more than 40% of Americans not fully vaccinated and with the breakthrough cases. And that takes us to Lena Wen point number two. COVID-19 treatments, where are we?
Yeah, so this is really important. And actually, just this morning, Merck announced that they are applying for emergency use authorization for an oral outpatient pill, for this pill, this antiviral called molnupiravir. And it's actually really important because, first of all, as you mentioned, there are people who are unvaccinated and who probably are not going to get vaccinated despite our best efforts. We want these individuals not to die, and we also don't want our hospitals to be overwhelmed. And according to Merck, their pill reduces the likelihood of hospitalization or death by 50%. So that's very important for the unvaccinated. But to your point, even for those who are vaccinated, people still can get breakthrough infections. And even though molnupiravir has not yet been tested in vaccinated individuals, I would hope that it will be at some point, so that individuals who are diagnosed early on in the course of their illness, even if they're vaccinated, can also take this to prevent progression to severe disease. Now, I do want to mention that first, this is not a replacement for a vaccine. Let's think about prevention as being the best medicine. Having the vaccine prevents you from getting COVID in the first place. And so oral treatment is not meant to be do that instead of getting vaccinated. But I do think that it's an important tool in our arsenal and really important to change the outlook of COVID from what otherwise would be a death sentence for many people.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're the one pronouncing this pill here, which has just come out. Your last point is better data to see where the virus is lurking, because half the cases we know are in people without symptoms. And that takes us to point number three, testing. So what are you prescribing here as far as testing?
Yeah, we really need widespread rapid testing that is so widely available that every American is able to get tested twice a week. This is not a pipe dream. This is actually what other countries are doing. The United Kingdom is providing free tests to all families up to twice a week if they wish. Singapore, Japan, they have tests available in ubiquitous vending machines across the country. The Biden administration has announced that they are quadrupling the rapid testing capability by the end of the year, which is fantastic. But I still don't think it gets us close to where we need to be. And by the way, early rapid testing is also really important for early treatment. Molnupiravir and other treatments like it only work if you're diagnosed early. And so if you have to be waiting 2 to 3 days for your results to come back, that also you're also not going to be able to get the early treatment benefit as well. And so we're pretty far off from this, but I hope that it becomes the norm for kids to get tested before going to school, or for families and friends before getting together, even for dinner parties, for people to get tested right before.
Yeah, well, we'll see where this goes. You do write about potentially getting to a point where people can be tested twice a week. That is Dr. Lena Nguyen, emergency physician and professor at George Washington University. Thanks, doctor, as always.
Thank you.
We have been hearing a lot about China's development projects around the world. China spends twice as much as the U.S. on international development. Case in point is China's Belt and Road Initiative. It's a massive infrastructure project connecting roads, railways, pipelines, trade routes across Asia, Europe, and Africa. But it's hit a snag in one key country, Pakistan. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
Passengers jostle to catch a late afternoon train here at the Rawalpindi station, not far from Pakistan's capital city, Islamabad. Porters ferrying battered suitcases on their heads expertly dip and weave among the crowds. The trains look positively antique, like they belong on the set of Downton Abbey.
The railway lines here at the Rawalpindi train station were laid down by the British during the colonial era, and they've not been upgraded since. Now the Chinese are coming in to modernize the system with new technology and to lay down new lines.
The plan to modernize the decrepit rail system is part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, better known as CPEC. It was conceived in 2015. Farooq Patafi, a columnist with the Express Tribune newspaper in Islamabad, says at that time, Pakistan was in a really bad place.
Pakistan was going through all the terrorism, and whatever was happening in Pakistan was so abysmal, so horrible. But then China's president comes to Pakistan and introduces these projects.
Beijing approached Pakistan with an offer of $42 billion in investments and loans to upgrade its infrastructure. CPEC was hailed as an important showcase for China's Belt and Road Initiative. And it started off with a bang. Chinese companies quickly built several power plants to help Pakistan alleviate its chronic electricity shortages, and many new roadways, says Patafi.
If you have traveled on any of these roads, you will be impressed that it really connects Pakistan. And when I used to drive before, it was horrible. Now it is quite a cakewalk driving on those roads.
But now, 6 years on, many CPEC projects are stalled because of COVID, political infighting in Pakistan, contract disputes, and charges of corruption on both sides. Harun Sharif, an economist and former chairman of Pakistan's Board of Investment, says Pakistanis are taking a harder look at what they need.
So far, we are buying whatever China is telling us to do. They say make economic zones, we'll make economic zones. But me and few others are pushing hard that we need to come up with our own model, what is good for us.
CPEC projects have also slowed because of cultural differences. Talat Shabir is with the Institute of Strategic Studies, Islamabad. He says Pakistan struggles to match China's pace in building large-scale projects.
In China, you have examples where they built a bridge of 2 kilometers in 30 days. They built a building of 20 stories in 20 days. So we are very slow. We have many bureaucratic impediments. So we are grappling with this problem.
Some projects are in places caught up in Pakistan's internal problems. That includes restive Balochistan province, where the Chinese are developing the port of Gwadar, considered the crown jewel of CPEC. Chinese workers there and elsewhere have been killed by militants in an effort to discourage Chinese investment. Sharif says Beijing is putting pressure on Pakistan to stop the attacks.
They have legitimate concern because physical security of Chinese workers is extremely critical. Now the other security thing which has put alarm bells in China is if Afghanistan gets destabilized,
which could lead to greater cross-border attacks. But Elizabeth Threlkeld, director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C., says despite the setbacks, it's unlikely China will walk away from its multi-billion dollar investment.
What I imagine happening going forward is just a focus more on finishing up the projects that have started, making some very limited future investments, but I do not expect any additional mega projects.
Which means those new rail lines in Rawalpindi may just have to wait. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Islamabad.
Today is Columbus Day, a federal holiday, but this year President Biden has also proclaimed today Indigenous Peoples Day to, as he put it, recognize Indigenous peoples' resilience and strength, as well as the immeasurable positive impact they have made on American society. And on this day, we spend a little time with singer-songwriter William Prince. He was born a member of the Peguis First Nation. Last year, Prince released two albums, Reliever and Gospel First Nation, which explores the complicated relationship between Christianity and Indigenous people in Canada. Here's the title song.
Up there on Gospel First Nation, the highway feels like salvation. In days of childhood, wondered how I would wind up where I am today. Just need to see it for yourself. Does something for your health. If we left right now, I could show you. I swear Jesus just might live along with all our sins in Fisher Bay, Manitoba.
William Prince spoke with our own Peter O'Dowd in October 2020.
And let's talk about that song. I looked up Fisher Bay, Manitoba, because I had never heard of it before. Population 45. Is that the same place you're singing about?
It is. I think it's technically a place, if you look it up on Wikipedia. It's not even a town. It's a place. A very special place.
Yeah, tell me about it. What was it like to grow up there?
I grew up just south of Fisher Bay on the reserve, Peguis First Nation. To get to Fisher Bay, you drive through Peguis First Nation, then you drive through Fisher River Cree Nation, and it eventually leads you to the end of the highway, which is this beautiful kind of spot to sit and look out over the vast Lake Winnipeg, this beautiful body of water, and there's a tree line way in the distance, and it's just beautiful, serene sky and water.
Well, the title of your new album, Gospel First Nation, seems to refer to the two sides of your very interesting identity, one as a Native person and the other as a Christian. What does Gospel First Nation mean to you?
Gospel First Nation is a delicate blend of two very important realms in my life. I have heritage that links back to Chief Peguis, the founder of the Peguis First Nation Reserve in Manitoba. And my grandfathers, Albert Prince and Edward Prince Sr., the men my dad would have grown up around, they were the founding pastors of the Prince Memorial Chapel. That's a church that's been standing there since 1929 on the Peguis Reserve. And, you know, so just as much the grandson of a great chief as I am a great preacher. And there's a interesting conversation around Christianity and gospel music, because these were the tools of the oppressor, so to say, to colonize and assimilate and ultimately extinguish First Nations Indian identity in Canada. So I try to extract the joy from it, and the album is around the nostalgia of playing songs, learning music through these old hymns and choruses with my dad playing for different communities.
Well, in fact, your dad wrote one of the songs on your album. This is called This One I Know.
As I walk through this world and its trials, I was weak from the sin and distress. There I was in total denial, as I searched for that heaven of rest.
You've already said this very well, that Native people have had a complicated relationship with Christianity in North America, because of course it was used to assimilate Indigenous people into Western culture. So tell me more about that, William. How have you grappled with that conflict?
I was very much inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement, where so many people at the hands of a racist North American justice system are being mistreated generation after generation. And when declaring my solidarity with these folks as a First Nations person, because in Canada, we're quick to say, at least we're not as bad in terms of racial relations as the United States, when the truth is the nationalism of great Canadian pride, this gathering place of many cultures and accepting nature and politeness and hockey and, you know, great spirit. Just beneath the floorboards is the history and rightful entitlement to the land by the First Nations people, who are now mistreated and cast out so that there can be this development of pipelines and industry without consent, mm-hmm. without any respectful dialogue with them. And these are members of my family who are affected by the generational trauma inflicted by the church.
So when those members of your family and your neighbors and other members of First Nations in Canada, like, hear your music and they see how far it's getting you, like, how do they respond? Is there any resentment that you've embraced this side of your identity?
No, because this is a common tale. The truth is, there were a lot of First Nations people raised in the church who have similar memories of fellowship and community. And I've seen these songs lift spirits in the darkest, bleakest places. Some First Nations communities where suicide is an ongoing epidemic, the effects of, you know, sexual abuse, alcoholism, substance abuse inflicted by a government. And so it is a delicate thing to sing about. I understand that. And you can put some rationality to it as long as you want, but the truth is, it's just coming from a place of honesty where I shared these songs with my family and I wanted to kind of capture this sound.
Yeah. Well, let's stay with that theme of alcoholism, substance abuse. Here's a song called Higher Power. It's written by Bob Norman, a First Nations man from the Meadow Lakes region of Saskatchewan.
Yes, there's a higher power, and now I know his name. When I called on Jesus into my life, he came. He took away my cravings and he washed away my sins. He changed this alcoholic into a child of a king.
Every good country artist has a song about drinking. They don't often invoke God in the same song. And then gospel music doesn't often invoke drinking at all, which is what makes this song so interesting to me. Tell me about this issue, though, of alcoholism. Is this something that you've struggled with in your own life or that you've seen firsthand?
My dad was an alcoholic, and he thankfully got a hold of it as he met my mom and changed his life and was a speaker for AA for many years. Of course, AA has its connections to spirituality, so it's and it runs prevalent in the First Nations community. There's a lot of turmoil because of addiction to alcohol, and it's stemming far back. Alcohol was brought over by the colonizers, the settlers, and a dependency was formed on it. And today, you know, my spirituality, I wouldn't define myself as Christian anymore. I very much believe in the universe, and I'm a scientist as much as I am a believer. I can thank and declare, you know, thank you, Lord, for this day. Thank you for opportunity, choice, privilege, safety. You can have this dialogue of gratitude that ultimately will attract better things in your life, I believe. I owe all of this. This very conversation we're having about another record is because of a continued campaign of giving thanks for where I get to be and how I get to live my life.
Well, in fact, this is the second record you've released in 2020. So let's take a moment just to talk about the first one. Here's a track from Reliever, which was released earlier this year. It's called The Spark.
When the ashes of lost love make it hard to breathe, my love, if we burn, would you burn right next to me?
Country music doesn't really have a reputation for being diverse. I just wonder if you've had any hurdles to clear as your career advances because of who you are.
I'm not obstructed by any hurdle. As a First Nations person, I'm used to having to work 25% harder for the equal amount of respect anyway. So I very much believe in, if you're good at something, you'll tell everybody, and if you're great, they'll let you know, you know? And so I've let the songs speak for themselves. That's all I've ever wanted, to be judged solely on my art and the merit of that art.
Well, plus your voice, that baritone, how could people do anything but embrace it? I mean, just tell me about your voice. Has it always felt so powerful to you as it sounds now?
Not at all. It was something I fought for a while. I had young person ambitions of being in a alt-rock band, and you had to be a bit of a wailer. I think of like the Miles Kennedys of the world and the great singers, you know, Robert Plant and such. And it's like, that's not who I am. That's not how I produce sound and use. Once you unlock the idea that your voice is an instrument, it blends itself to a whole new category of uniqueness. Think of the great voices, Tom Petty and, you know, Neil Young, the great Bob Dylan. And these voices evolve and do wonderful things over time, and I hope that I can lend myself to that too.
William Prince, the new album is Gospel First Nation. Thank you so much. It was a joy to listen to it.
Thank you, Peter.
Granted, Jesus is my plea.
That's our conversation from October 2020.
Daily walking close to thee. Let it be, dear Lord, let it be.
A nationwide blood study in 8 U.S. cities could eventually make it easier for gay and bisexual men to donate blood. Right now, federal rules ban some LGBTQ people from the blood bank. And to move things forward, one study in Central Florida is seeking 150 more men to enroll. Danielle Pryor of member station WMFE in Orlando reports.
Blake Lynch says he'll never forget the first time he tried to give blood. It was 2013, and Lynch was a Central Florida nursing student. He was excited to donate in honor of a classmate with sickle cell anemia. Lynch says he filled out the questionnaire that's required of all donors. Shortly thereafter, he got the news.
They're like, Blake, I'm sorry, but you can't donate blood. I was like, why can't I donate? And they were like, well, I see you're gay, so that means you're banned for life.
The lifetime federal ban was eliminated in 2015, but today, gay and bisexual men still have to wait 3 months between sex and blood donation. That's where the advanced study comes in. One Blood Blood Bank and the LGBT Center in Orlando have teamed up to collect blood samples from 18 to 39-year-old men who have sex with men. The FDA will review these samples along with answers from a survey to see if a few quick questions can accurately predict someone's risk for passing on certain STIs. One Blood Senior VP of Communications, Susan Forbes, says a change in the FDA's current policy would automatically increase the number of blood donors in Central Florida and throughout the country.
Less than 10% of the population donates blood, when upwards of 40% are eligible but don't.
About 100 men have already enrolled in the advanced study at the LGBT Center in Orlando. They fill out a simple survey, get their blood drawn, and then return for a follow-up visit and get paid $85. But George Wallace, the center's director, says participating in the study is about more than just the money. It's about fighting decades-old medical stigma and discrimination against the LGBTQ community.
This is not a special right. This is a basic right that we should be able to have to not be stigmatized, because HIV is not only a gay or bisexual men's disease.
Orlando State Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith is working to get about 150 more men enrolled in the study. He says along with making history, the study could also save lives during and after emergencies like the coronavirus pandemic or the Pulse shooting.
There were so many gay and bi men who wanted to give blood to save a life of someone who was clinging to life in a hospital here in Orlando after the terrible shooting that were turned away.
Guillermo Smith says he would have participated in the study himself, except for one tiny detail.
Because the cutoff is 39 and I'm 40. So instead, what I've been doing is I've been reaching out to a lot of my friends and my chosen family, including my own husband, who participated in the trial.
And years after being turned away from giving blood, nurse Blake Lynch and his husband Brett also participated in the advanced study. Lynch says if the current FDA blood donation policy gets overturned, he already knows how they're going to celebrate.
I'm scheduling a date with my husband Brett, and we are both going out to donate blood.
Altogether, when the study's done enrolling participants in March 2022, some 2,000 men will have enrolled throughout the country with the hopes of making history and saving countless lives. For Here and Now, I'm Danielle Pryor in Orlando.
That was Diana Kipyoge of Kenya crossing the finish line. Earlier, her countryman Benson Kipruto won on the men's side on this first Boston Marathon Monday since April of 2019. Reporter Alex Ashlock is our favorite person to talk to on these days, and he's near the finish line. Hey, Alex.
Great to be with you, Scott.
Okay, let's start with the women's race. What'd you see?
Well, I was right there when she crossed the finish line, and you heard all those cheering crowds, and it was so great to be back in downtown Boston for a marathon since there hasn't been one for 2.5 years. It was just great to see all the people on the streets and just incredible cheering for her when she finished the race. It was really interesting, the women, a big pack early on, lots of women sharing the lead. But at the point in the race where the course turns by a firehouse and heads up into these hills in Newton, she took off. She took, made a break, and she really controlled the race from there. And
is that where we've heard of Heartbreak Hill? Is that where she took off?
Yeah, it was right. It was a little bit before that, but it's typically where the races sometimes are decided in that part of the race. It's about 18, 19, 20 miles in, and she just controlled it from there and won the race easily. Kenyan women also finished second, third, and fourth. Good day for Kenya on the women's side.
And on the men's side. So was there any drama before Kipruto on the men's side crossed the tape?
You know, the funny thing, or not funny, but interesting thing about the men's race is you don't often see this in marathons, but American C.J. Albertson just took off by himself early on in the race. He was out there in front. I think he was ahead by 1:40 at some point. And he ran that way for a long time, but eventually the pack caught up with him. And that often happens as well. Kipruto, I think he took the lead around 3 miles to go and won the race by more than 40 seconds. Albertson said he didn't regret the front running, and he finished 10th. I should mention, though, Scott, I should also point out that the wheelchair races today, which were the ones I found really fascinating, because you saw Kenyans in the men's and women's races, a Swiss sweep in the women's and men's wheelchair races. Marcel Hoog, Manuel Achar. Hoog won here for the fifth time, winning Boston for the fifth time. Schar for the third time. And Hoog, he won despite making a wrong turn on the course, which you don't often see. So that was kind of interesting. Daniel Romanchuk finished second in the men's wheelchair race. And yesterday in the Chicago Marathon, he beat Hoog. So Hoog got some revenge today, and he talked about their rivalry.
We'll have a big showdown in New York. It's a totally different course, a different marathon. We have time now to recover.
Yeah, wow. Well, what an essential ritual day for the city of Boston coming back, as you describe, Alex, for the first time in 2 years plus. Thanks, Alex Ashlock, near the finish line. Yeah, great to talk to you.
You're welcome, Scott.
And to Alaska now, where salmon runs have sustained generations of native people in small fishing communities. But now, in many parts of the state, those runs have dwindled. And that includes the Chignik River along the Alaska Peninsula. Residents there are now struggling to store enough fish for the winter. Izzy Ross of Alaska's Energy Desk has more from a group that fears it's losing a fishing tradition.
That used to be a restaurant there.
Gene Carlson drives through the narrow, winding streets of Chignik Bay.
And those across over there, that's a Webloft over there, which is shut down now. There's another one of my cousin's houses. He's not living there anymore.
The Chignik area has been home to Native people for millennia. And in the late 1800s, Chignik Bay was established as a fishing community as more people of Aleutic, Aleut, Russian, and Scandinavian descent moved to the area. Now, about 90 residents live here year-round. During the summer, people would normally be out fishing commercially or filling smokehouses with subsistence catch. But for 4 years now, the sockeye and chinook returns to Chignik have been extremely low.
It is what it is, I guess. Kind of glad I'm old. Because, you know, the younger people are going to have to do something else. Because there's just no way they're going to be able to have a lifestyle of any sort with this kind of fishing.
Carlson was born in Chignik Bay and has fished commercially since he was a kid in 1961. Now he lives in Washington State and usually returns for the summer. But he says this may be his last season here.
If we have another prediction like this year, I don't think I can come back, you know. It's expensive. Because, you know, when we come back, we bring food for the whole summer. And because we got to feed our crews, which you can't even find anymore.
The village of Chignik Lagoon is about an hour's boat ride along the bay's shoreline.
And it's protected by the sandstone because of the natural breakwater. See it up ahead of us here.
George Anderson fishes commercially and for subsistence. He's also the president of the Chignik Intertribal Coalition, which was formed after the run collapsed in 2018. Earlier this past summer, the run was so low that some people chose not to put out nets for subsistence fish. They were worried about harming the fragile run.
It's something that we took for granted in the past, that the fish were just always going to be there for, you know, smoking, salting, freezer, whatever. And to have that not be there for you is just something we're never prepared for. Never imagined even not subsisting.
Some scientists have connected fisheries failures in the Gulf of Alaska to marine heat waves. But state research biologists also say it could be because of habitat changes in the salmon's spawning grounds. Since the Chignik Run collapsed, much of the debate has centered on another state-run fishery to the south, called Area M. Critics see it as an intercept fishery, where sockeye traveling through are harvested before they can reach fisheries closer to spawning grounds like Chignik. Anderson says it feels like the Chignik villages are shouldering the burden of conservation when the run is low. While the state has restricted Chignik fishing, fishermen further south are still allowed to go out and harvest. They haven't yet received the federal disaster relief money they were promised after the 2018 failure either. Kevin Schaberg is a finfish research coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
It's hard to understand that, you know, everybody else gets to go fishing, but you got to sit home next to the river and watch no fish go by. And that's tough, and it's something that we've tried to handle in the past.
In previous years, he says, the department has limited fishing in nearby areas when Chignik was low. But he says the burden of conserving a run usually falls on areas closest to where those fish should be returning to spawn, like in the lakes at the head of the Chignik River. He says the department plans to research whether something in the watershed is contributing to the run's decline. In the meantime, other organizations have tried to help. Last summer, a commercial processor donated thousands of Bristol Bay sockeye to the Chignik's. Locals say receiving that fish was amazing. But subsistence isn't just about food. It's also a connection to place and family as people work together to harvest. Elder Vivian Brandle is 80 and has lived in the Chignik area all her life. Now she goes to Kodiak in the winter. She says it's difficult to comprehend what is happening.
Subsistence fishing is a lifeline. That's something we've done all our life. It's something we really depend on, actually, not only fishing, but we used to be able to get caribou. We'd get caribou every year. You can't even do that anymore.
Brandle says the lower sockeye runs have changed the future of the Chignik communities.
That's five villages that depend on this fishery, and you look at it, you think, how can the state let this happen? How can they just let this happen without doing anything about it? I have grandchildren that thought this was their legacy.
She wants the state to study why the fish aren't coming back and to be more responsive.
We believe in this and we should fight for it. And I won't be able to anymore, but I just think the young people really ought to. You know, it's very emotional for people. You look sorry. I shouldn't be crying. This is crazy. But it is very hard.
Brandel hopes people in Chignik can work together to help their community survive. For Here and Now, I'm Izzy Ross.
Sometimes something big changes in the world, and smart brains want to study it. Say when there's a military draft. Do the draftees end up making more money than others, or less? Or when the minimum wage goes up, do fewer jobs get created in reality, or perhaps more? These studies are called natural experiments, and this year's Nobel Prize in Economics goes to three giants in this field: David Card, Joshua Angrist, and Hido Imbens. And we have Professor Imbens on the line. He's professor of economics at Stanford University. Welcome, sir, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, sir.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about this field and why economists get so excited about these experiments. I'm fascinated by it. I just read this morning that this allows people to study, say, the 1918 flu and what happened to babies exposed in utero to this versus those that were not, and whether there are any cognitive differences. How do you describe to the rest of us why natural experiments are so important to study?
Well, it's because we're trying to learn about causal effects. We want to know what would actually happen if you change something. And in many cases, we can't do proper randomized experiments of the type that drug companies do, that the Food and Drug Administration insists on for new vaccines or for new drugs or for new medical treatments. And so we can't do that in social science settings, say with education. And so we need to find places where somehow there was some random variation in the things we care about. We can see indirectly figure out what the causal effect is. So it's settings where we would like to do experiments, but we can't for the ethical reasons, for financial reasons. It's not feasible.
But sometimes something happens in nature or something happens with policy, and suddenly, bam, you have a study there, something to study.
But if you look carefully, that happens much more than you might think.
And now, in this pandemic, I imagine it's given rise to a lot of natural experiments that scholars are probably doing right now, I imagine. I don't know, comparing one state with certain lockdowns with the state next door to it that did not impose lockdowns and how things turned out, that kind of thing?
No, but of course, that's very challenging because often it's not just one particular measure that differs between the two states, but it's a whole set of measures as well as attitudes and responses from people. So disentangling the cause and from the simple correlations is very hard. And so we keep trying to improve the methods and trying to improve our understanding there. And it's, you know, from that perspective, it's just been great working with people, having had as colleagues, people like Card and Angrist, to kind of help improve the methodology there and make their work more convincing and credible.
Now, Angrist, I gather, was he the best man at your wedding? Have you spoken to him today?
So he's a very close personal friend. But David Card was my colleague at Berkeley. I think actually I may be one of the very few people who's had both Josh and David as colleagues, and they were just terrific colleagues and very good friends.
And have you shared any words with one another today? I'm just curious what you said to one another.
I've talked to Josh. And we reminisced about our early days when we were both in Harvard housing that at that time didn't have laundry facilities in each apartment. So we would kind of spend Saturday mornings in the Harvard laundromat talking about work and talking about ideas and papers we'd read. So I'm just thrilled to be sharing it with them. They've been great colleagues. I've learned an enormous amount from them.
This great moment for you is, of course, occasion to think back, to look back into economics and why you went into it. Can you share with us what led you to dive into the field of economics in the first place?
So that wasn't particularly well thought through. When I was in high school, I grew up in the Netherlands. And so there, while you're in high school, when you apply for university, you apply for a particular major. I chose econometrics. It was, in fact, a separate major at the universities in Holland, thanks to Tim Berg, and was actually the first Nobel laureate in economics. He'd set up that program. And so I like doing mathematics, but I wanted to do something a little bit more with real world applications. And this seemed a good mix of the two.
And it's so kind of relevant and understandable to the rest of us. Real world questions, questions of earnings, economic realities. I guess my last question for you is, you know, given how relevant this stuff can be, is it time to retire the term dismal science? I imagine you hate when people refer to economics as a dismal science.
yes, you know, that was never a term that really resonated much with me. I just found the questions exciting. It just gets me up in the morning. I'm excited to go to work. I felt very fortunate yesterday. I feel even more fortunate today.
I can hear your excitement. That is Hedo Imbens, one of three winners of the Nobel Economics Prize today. Congratulations, sir. Thanks.
Thanks very much, sir.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. And thanks for listening on Indigenous Peoples Day. It's Here and Now.